I'm Laura Vinroot Poole. For 20 years, I've owned Capital, an internationally recognized specialty store. Capital has never really been about fashion. It's always been about people. What we wore was created to share the meaningful journeys that inspire me. From the designers and friends I meet on the road to the men and women with whom I work each day.
Everybody wants to know her.
Alexis Smart is a former model and actress turned flower remedy and homeopathic practitioner. On this episode, we discuss the healing properties of flowers, homeopathic medicine, and her new collection of flower remedies. Alexis, tell me where you're from.
I was born in Toronto, Canada, raised in Los Angeles. Yeah, secret Canadian. And my parents are both from England. They met in Canada, and but we left Canada when I was pretty young, around four, and then I lived in Mexico for a year with them, of course, and then we settled in LA, and that's where I've been mostly my whole life.
And I think that I've heard that your parents are both artists.
Yeah, my mom is an astrologer and herbalist and a singer, musician, and my dad is a visual artist, painter, illustrator, sculptor.
Have people always connected you to Joni Mitchell?
Well, no, actually, it's weird. I hit a certain age and then suddenly it started. And then but before that, it never happened. And I'm not sure what happened. My face changed or something. Maybe as I got some more cheekbones or something.
Well, that's a good comparison, though.
It is. It's great.
What was it like being raised by two artists?
I have to say, like, when I was a kid, you know, when you're a kid, you want to conform, and you want, like, everyone at school had the sandwiches at lunch that, like, on white bread with bologna and a strip of bright yellow mustard, and I wanted that, you know, and I had, like, the weird hippie sprout sandwich in a greasy brown paper bag, and I always wanted the conventional and the conformity when I was very young. Mm-hmm. And then as I got older, I started appreciating their aesthetic and their point of view. And now I realize that the way they raised me has really helped me kind of with all of my career choices and the way my life is going now. I feel like there was just nothing expected of me. I was kind of allowed to be my own person. I didn't have to do homework. I didn't have to do anything. But so everything was kind of by choice. I think that's important.
Were you an only child, Alexis?
No, I have a sister, an older sister. We're close in age. We fought all the time. But, you know, we're also companions and compatriots. And yeah, so that was the four of us. And I rarely had a babysitter. So my parents brought us everywhere to parties and to adult things. So I think that was really enriching for me. To go to things that most parents would think their kids would be bored at, you know, to museums and art things and stuff like that.
And do you think it informed your style?
I do. My parents now, I'm realizing, like, they're very stylish and they're not trendy, you know, so even just their influence, they're kind of maybe even snobby about, you know, like, not following trends and kind of quality and stuff like that and realness. And so definitely I think that's influenced me.
Do you have pieces from your mom's wardrobe that you've borrowed? Oh,
yes.
Because I've met you before and you are so beautiful and you are so, you have the most incredible style. So I do know if some of that is swiped from your mom's wardrobe.
It's funny. I always think I have no style, but I think it's just that I don't know what my style is. I'm sure they're accidentally stylish, I would call it. But my mom, I realized she shopped like the French. You know, she didn't have a lot of clothes, but she had, like, really beautiful, timeless pieces that all of them I could wear today, and the ones that weren't eaten by moths and stuff. So, like, my favorite one of hers is she had a friend in Toronto that had this incredible store called like Morningstar Trading or something. And he had things from all over the world and vintage Afghani pieces. So I have this dress of hers that's a Syrian vintage dress from, it could be the 30s, and it's embroidered and it's black with really bright embroidered thread on it. And I wear that all the time. And it's kind of like you could dress it up or, you know, wear it with boots in the desert where I live now. And it's just, it's one of my favorites.
Your first career was as a model and an actress?
Yes. Well, when I was young, you know, and through teenage years, I was a ballet dancer and really into dancing. And but I wanted to be a writer. So that's kind of where I was heading. And then when I was 15 or so, people said, oh, you should model and make some money. And my friend entered me into this elite modeling contest. But I kind of won a contract with them when I was 15 and did that for a year. And then it kind of it railroaded me. You know, there was promise of like travel and adventure and a lot of money. And I thought, well, I'll just do this maybe for a few years, like take a break after high school and do this. And then it just kind of kept going. And then I ended up doing it for like, you know, until I was 30.
Wow.
Maybe even later, because I, you know, LA is not the biggest editorial fashion mecca. So I did commercials, and I met this commercial director. I auditioned for him, named Joe Pitka, who is pretty famous, big commercial director. And he really loved me, and he cast me in all these Pepsi commercials. So yeah, I couldn't get out of it. I kept saying it was like the mafia, you know, you're in for life. And it just afforded me a lot of freedom. And I traveled a lot, and I had fun. I still did, you know, I did writing workshops, and I did keep writing through all those years. But then it just started becoming like, I didn't really want to be an actress, and I didn't want to be famous. And it just was, the commercial thing was just getting monotonous. And I was having a lot of like soul searching questions about, you know, what my purpose was. And then right around that time, I had a lot of fateful kind of tragedies in my life. I lost a number of people in a short span and went to Egypt and got malaria and got really sick. And the illness lasted for a number of years because nobody could diagnose it in LA. That no one asked me if I'd been traveling to a foreign country or so I was just getting sicker. And then I was treated with flower remedies. I accidentally met someone who did that, and my whole life changed in like 3 weeks. Huh. And I decided to quit acting and study this because it blew my mind, study flower remedies. And I felt healthier than I'd felt in years and happier. And it was so transformative. I was like, this is my calling.
Wow. So I've read that this happened around your Saturn return.
Will you
talk to the audience about that?
About yes.
What that means and kind of
I how will.
Significant.
Even people who don't know of astrology, they always hear about like 20, you know, age 27. Yeah. and how all these rock stars died at that age. And it is kind of eerie how many people have died at that age, and they think it's some kind of cursed thing that happens to you at the time. But my mom is an astrologer, so I grew up hearing about what that is. And she described it as that Saturn is a very slow moving planet. I think it takes 27 to 30 years to make one complete cycle. So it takes that long to get back to it where it was when you were born.
Right.
So when you hit that age, she said Saturn is the planet that teaches you lessons if you haven't learned the things you need to know, right, that your soul needs to know. So it's not a curse and a bad thing. It's kind of, some people go through it without any challenges because they've evolved a certain way, but life will give you challenges that help you learn what you need to learn for the next cycle of your life. And that definitely happened. My whole being and life changed then. So, you know, it's thought of as usually like horrible things happen during your Saturn return. You could die, people die, just you lose your business.
Yeah,
lots of stuff. It is strange. I don't know if you had a similar. Oh, yeah.
I've definitely had my Saturn, my first and maybe my second Saturn return. I'm almost 50. But back to, can I ask you one question about your mom? Yeah. Did she talk about astrology growing up? Like, did you understand what Saturn return was when you were a kid? Or is that something that...
Yeah. What's funny is, you know, when, you know how if your dad is an accountant and they want you to go into business, you're like, ugh, I hate numbers and money. And so I kind of rejected, she would talk about astrology or talk about things going on in my chart as a kid, and I just kind of zone out. But when I was older, I knew what that was. But somehow, when I was going through the Saturn return, I didn't think, oh my God, it's my Saturn return. And nobody said, my mom didn't even say it. Maybe she did, but I was so in shock, I don't remember anything. Yeah, I didn't realize till way later, oh my God, that's what happened.
Yeah. And so with the malaria, what?
Oh my God. I'd had a bad breakup in LA with someone I lived with, and I couldn't handle like going to look for an apartment. So I thought, oh, I'll just leave the country. That's my solution. So I went traveling, and I'd gone to England and Spain and Greece, where I'd always wanted to go my whole life. And I spent a few months in Greece on islands. And then I didn't want to come home when it got cold there. I think it wasn't even that cold, but it was cold for Greece. My friend, an Australian Greek guy, said, why don't we go to Egypt? It's so close and I've always wanted to go. So we went there, and this was before I didn't have a cell phone. So, you know, I said, research and see if we need shots or vaccines or, and he said, no, we're good to go. And so I didn't really research what the possible dangers were. And we spontaneously decided to go to this oasis called Siwa, which is Siwa?
Yeah, I know Siwa. I want to go so badly. I've been to Egypt, but
what?
Yes, I'm obsessed with Siwa, and it's very dangerous, right? Like, because there's only one road in and one road out.
Yes,
I'm really, really into Siwa.
I always had an obsession with ancient Egypt, and I collected Egyptian things when I was 4 and 5. Like, I just loved Egypt. And I was in Cairo, and I was staying, actually my grandparents met in Egypt, my father's parents, during the war. I didn't know that till after I'd gone there. And so I was staying in this old hotel, and the bar had been the British Officers Club during the war, which I didn't know that they probably had gone there. It was just very faded kind of trip. Yeah. And I met these Egyptian architects who were really great. These two guys, and I was saying, you know, where should we want to get out of Cairo? Where should we go? That I don't want to go where tourists go. Where do Egyptians go? And he said, oh, you've got to go to Siwa. It's magical. Mm-hmm. So I liked the sound of that. We had to go to Alexandria, and then it's like a 12-hour bus ride across the mm-hmm. desert. Sometimes you're, you know, by the sea, like to your right, you see the ocean. And then you come there, and it's like, it's really like a movie of an oasis, where it's just in the middle of nowhere. And then suddenly you just see like this wall of palm trees, like a circle of appearing out of nowhere. And you drive in, and it's like the town is just a big circle. And it's just filled with, there's like, I think 100,000 date palms and olive trees. And there are the salt lakes there that look opalescent. And I mean, it's just, and it's out of time. There were all these, you know, donkey carts and men in traditional garb and Berbers. So, you know, in Cairo, the influence felt more kind of Arabic, mm-hmm. Egyptian. And in Siwa, the people were just stunningly beautiful. Like, I don't know if you've seen those kind of National Geographic pictures of Berber women, but like just their coloring and and the clothes they wore, I'm telling you, I would wear all of the dresses these girls wore. They were like calico and floral long prairie dresses. I mean, I don't know where they got this influence in the middle of the desert, you know? So we left Siwa. We were there for quite a while. Like, we meant to go for 2 days, and maybe we were there for 3 weeks. There were all these travelers there too that had intended to stay a few days that just, oh, I've been here 2 years. What? And so we left there, and I think we went to Aswan. And when we got to Aswan, I woke up with the worst headache of my life. Like, just, I thought I was having a brain hemorrhage because my mom had had one. And I thought, oh my God, it's happening to me now. And by then I was fighting with my traveling companion and trying to quit smoking. So I was, and we were at odds. So there was no person with me that was saying, hey, you don't look right. Something's wrong. And I was kind of wandering around this dusty village looking for aspirin or something, or a doctor. And it's all a blur after that. I just remember that I was freezing cold all of a sudden. And then I started shivering, like my whole body was shaking. And then I would bundle up in all these clothes and then get a really high fever and sweat through them. And this was going on for a few days. And I kept saying, I don't feel right. Something's wrong. And then it would pass, like 2 or 3 days later, I'd feel fine and think, wow, that was weird. I got some crazy Egyptian flu. And then I came back to LA and it happened on the plane. So when I arrived, I had this active shivering fever. I kept thinking it was a flu, and then because it would go away, it was cyclical. And then I had it for 5 years, and it was, I met an Egyptian woman at an art gallery and we were chatting. There were Egyptian photos on the wall and we were talking about Egypt and kind of mentioned this. Oh yeah, I don't remember Aswan. I was sick there. And I told her my symptoms and she said, oh, you had malaria, real casual.
Oh my God.
And she said, it's common there. And anyway, so it was like through a long series of.
So when she said that, were you like, oh my God, that's it?
Yes. Well, this was like, so I'd gotten the symptoms before everyone could just Google everything. And then, but by the time I met her, you know, I had Google and the computer and everything. And I ran home and I Googled the symptoms and it and Egypt. And it said, like, don't worry about malaria, travelers to Egypt, unless you go to Siwa during August through October. Went, oh my God.
Oh my God.
It was like a veil had been lifted, because for 5 years I'd had this mystery illness. And yeah, it was kind of through trying to get help for that I found all these alternative healing methods and stuff.
And so started with like Bach flower essences, or I mean, how did you?
Yes. I had mostly been focusing on my body, and I'd been going to healers and doing cleanses and trying to address my physical symptoms. And I had not yet heard that it might be malaria. So, but I just knew I didn't feel right. And then during that time, I started getting panic attacks, and I'd feel really faint all the time. And just like I wasn't in my body, which is like a common thing when you have a pretty severe pathogen parasite. You can definitely feel not present. And
yeah.
So I was getting anxious and like, I couldn't drive. I was white knuckling it. I was having crazy energy swings. And I somehow walked into the store in LA and said, do you have anything for panic attacks? It was, they'd had a sign for like natural remedies in the window. And there was a woman there who made me a formula, a flower remedy formula. We didn't even really discuss much of anything. And she said, take this. In 3 days, you'll feel a lot better. And in 3 weeks, you'll be a new person. And I really wanted to be a new person. I was not happy with that person. I just believed her. She had a kind of authority about her. And I did it. And I didn't really know much about Bach flower remedies. My mom had given us rescue remedy, but I hadn't explored it. So I took these remedies and it was exactly as she said. And 3 weeks later, I was a totally new person. And I felt so good, even physically, more energetic and strong. And I changed all these things in my life that were wrong, like, you know, wrong boyfriend and wrong agent. And
always that.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you finished the bottle, did you know what the flowers were?
Yeah. She wrote it down on the label for me. And then I said, yeah. Do you have any info? And she gave me some little booklet from the flower remedy company that had like one line about each remedy. Mm-hmm. And it was incredibly accurate how she had figured out my personality. As soon as I had that 3 week mark and I felt different, I started studying it. I was just fascinated, and that's how I am. I always study things that have affected me. And so I learned about these remedies called Bach flower remedies that were invented in the 30s, or discovered, I should say, by this British doctor who was kind of pioneer in vaccines and quite ahead of his time with the gut microbiome and researching and stuff. And he was dissatisfied with medicine because he felt like it was only addressing the body and that the person himself or herself was being ignored. And They might cure somebody of arthritis, but that person still might be depressed or anxious. And he said, that's not a complete cure, in my view. A person should be happy. Like, the soul and the spirit were being totally ignored. And he also started believing, after he became a homeopath, that all illness begins in a disruption of the spirit, or in an emotional trauma, or from emotional stress. I mean, I've felt that in my life. Just, yeah. You know, when I'm upset or grief stricken, I always get a virus. So he thought, I want to find a system of healing that just addresses the emotions that people can use to treat themselves, that it's gentle, safe. You can treat your family with this. And so, you know, at the first sign of when you don't feel yourself, like, you know how usually before you get a cold or a flu, there's a day where you're like irritable, or you're spaced out, or you just feel off emotionally. Well, his theory was that if you take the correct flower remedy at that time, your body can heal itself. And so that was his goal. And he found 38 different flowers that affect the mood that he'd give for the personality. So that was really interesting kind of approach no one had ever done, except, well, homeopathy had, but not in conventional medicine, was to look at the patient and their personality. And so originally he found 12 remedies only, because he thought there were 12 types of people. And he'd, you know, water violet, I always talk about that one because it's one I take a lot. He'd give that to someone who had, you know, whatever their physical ailment was, if they matched the water violet personality, he'd give them that remedy and they'd get better. So water violet is for people who are kind of like to be alone and don't ask for help much and go their own way kind of people. But then he, after the 12, he thought, well, humans are complicated and there's all of these different emotional states and trauma and life events that can kind of change your personality. So he eventually, it was 38 different essences that he discovered. And they're just miraculous to me. They're really, well, like I said, ahead of their time, because they're kind of working more in principles of quantum physics. Like, they're very, very dilute. And they're called vibrational medicine because they affect your subtle energetic body. They're not like a herbal tincture that affects your organs and crude bodily stuff.
And Dr. Bach was in Germany?
He was in England. It's a Welsh name and it's meant to be pronounced Bach. That's how the Welsh say it.
So you studied Dr. Bach?
Yes.
And when did you start to take your own clients?
It was a few years, because I really didn't think I would do this professionally. It was just, I was just passionate about it. So I think for maybe 2 years, I studied it and I got a kit and I gave the remedies to everybody I knew and friends of friends. And I just said, like, let me treat you for free, but you have to give me feedback. And so I was studying and learning, but I really wanted hands-on experience and to see where I'd gone wrong and if my prescriptions were correct. And
it sounds like they were.
They were. And the great thing about these is you can't really do a wrong remedy. The worst that could happen is when you pick the wrong one, it just does nothing. Right. So sometimes I'd have someone that it didn't work, and on my second try, I would get it. And then at some point, like through the disillusionment with the acting thing and loving flower remedies more, it just conspired to create this career that people started insisting they pay me, and then they wanted to send other strangers to me, and so I started charging, and then I became a homeopath. So I thought, oh, flower remedy practitioner, that's not a job, because I hadn't heard of it. And then but I had been cured of the malaria by a homeopath, a British homeopath. So that's when I thought, oh my God, I have to study this too. I started studying homeopathy, and I did both of them. So I'm a homeopath as well.
Can you tell me what the difference between homeopathy and flower remedies are?
That is a great question. Yes. Homeopathy is a 200-year-old science invented by a man named Samuel Hahnemann. And the principle is that you give a remedy that in a larger amount would cause all of your symptoms. And we use things like poisons, like arsenic, belladonna, snake venom, or minerals, phosphorus, silica, plants, trees, any substance can be made into homeopathic remedy. So the idea is to stimulate your immune system to kind of rally against the disease, very much like the idea of vaccines, but these are very specific to the individual symptoms. So for homeopathy to work, it has to be very specific for your symptoms, and it has to be the right dosage and frequency, and requires a lot of case management. So usually, unless it's an acute, you'd want to see a professional. Flower remedies work by, rather than giving you something that would, you know, a negative or a poison, or it gives you something that it's only positive. And so, like I said earlier, if you take the wrong one, nothing can happen. And homeopathy is called like cures like, rather than like giving an antacid for acid stomach. You would actually give the patient something that causes acid stomach in a small amount. So with flower remedies, you're just kind of flooding the body with positive feelings. And then the idea is that the negativity kind of just drops away as you increase your positive feelings.
Because there's so much positive, it has to go away because it feels comfortable.
yeah, exactly. Even though people say homeopathy, if it's the wrong remedy, it does nothing. I have experienced myself when I take the wrong remedy, homeopathic remedy, I can get bad. So I can get some aggravations for a few days where I don't feel right. With flower remedies, that can never happen. So they're really safe for if you're pregnant, trying to conceive, nursing, they're safe for all of those stages.
What's the process of the flower, you know, getting the essences, or is it essences or?
Yes, essences. I get them from England. They're made in the English and Welsh countryside, and the flowers grow wild there. And that's the best way to get the material for the essences, because if they're cultivated, they have a different potency. They're not as strong. The healing messages aren't as strong. So I get my essences from a wonderful guy in England who makes the formula, the flower essences, exactly in accordance with Dr. Bach's preparation methods. Wow. And I visited them in England and seen their operation out in the countryside. And so I have the most respect for this person. And so I get the concentrates from England, and then I formulate them and make bottles for people.
What would you say are the three most common emotional states that you've seen over the years in treating clients?
I see mostly women. I'm not sure why women seek out self-care more than men do. I wish more men would. But so I know that like women have a whole different makeup, obviously. So the women that I see, I would say the one thing that a lot of them had, aside from more severe things like trauma and anxiety and stuff, would be they often doubt their intuition, or they go against their inner knowing, which I had for sure done, you know, where you kind of, you get a little inkling, or you get it. Oh yeah. The red flag.
Right.
And you go, you're just being silly or paranoid or whatever it is. And you kind of quiet that voice. So I see that a lot, but emotionally too, I see a lot of like fear of failure or fear of things not working out, or like a negative outlook, or just easily discouraged kind of, because it's like a realistic outlook is what they call it. And because we're all raised with this idea that you should kind of be prepared for things to go wrong. And so, but that kind of is, it inhibits your sense of adventure and feeling of spontaneity, and that like doesn't matter what happens, that what the outcome is, that life is an adventure, you know. And so I think like the majority of people may not be suffering with kind of intense psychological emotional stuff, but they have these kind of garden variety things that kind of dampen their joie de vivre. Yeah. You know,
for me, I've had doctors, you know, sort of look at you like you're crazy. And it's funny to talk to you. And also, I know you, I've met you several times, but I never knew that you were who you are. And when I had weird early perimenopausal problems, had gotten your Moon River formula. And it really, really helped me. And I think that's the thing, is like, you can go to the doctor like 100 times and just be like, I just don't feel right. Don't feel right. And they're like, well, you know, take an aspirin or we should put you on an antidepressant. And you're like, it's not that. And I feel like for me, the Moon River, it was just really comforting. It almost felt like it was someone saying, you're not crazy.
Yeah. Here's the thing. Like, the reason they say there's nothing wrong is just that there's only certain things that show up in lab reports. You know, I learned this in homeopathy school, that the things that show up in lab results are usually when a condition has gotten more extreme, right? But before that, it's kind of more like in a functional area. So something is happening. It just hasn't gotten so bad that it's showing up in a crude form and to me, like, I'd rather feel good and have a bad lab report than feel bad and have them say like there's nothing wrong. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. I have a question for you too. In treating patients, clients, mm-hmm. I think you obviously are very empathetic. What do you do to clear your energy in between clients?
I don't do so many of them back to back. I really need a time of recovery after. Like, often, like, I need to get in water. I know it sounds weird, but I want a shower or get in a bath, or I go out into the sun and stand on the ground and just ground myself. Mm-hmm. But I also, you know, I used to burn sage a lot, but then I made a room spray because I couldn't always burn sage between clients. A lot of people have allergies or just don't like the smell. And also, you know, if I was in a hurry and I'm kind of rapidly smudging the room and there's pieces of ash falling everywhere, it would be dramatic. So I made this beautiful room spray that has, because you can use flower essences topically and you can use them in environmentally. So I made a room spray with flower essences that to cleanse and protect, called Sun Moon Room Spray. But I got into the aromatherapy aspect of it, and I love scents. And so I thought I want it to also smell good and have therapeutic aromatherapy properties. So I do that, like, even though now in quarantine, I only do Zoom, but I still feel like I need to clear my environment after.
For sure.
So I do that. And I also have a formula called Pesos that I can't believe this is, I have 23 formulas, right? And like, after doing this for 18 years and being so empathetic and sensitive to people's energy, the 24th formula I make is one for empaths. I can't believe it took me this long to do that. And so I've been taking that, and I really find it helpful, especially during this time, you know, just with the suffering and just the collective emotional trauma that's going on right now. It can be overwhelming.
I love hearing you say that, because I actually just ordered Pathos.
Oh, you've got to. I mean, it's kind of the first one I made for a kind of type of person. A lot of the remedies are for different conditions, but this is really like a personality.
Yeah.
And if you are one, you just know.
Yes.
You know, everyone's learning about empaths lately, but before we use that word, we would say I'm very sensitive. I'm compassionate. I like helping people.
HSP, you know, highly sensitive person.
HSPs, yeah. and they're often very, I mean, I am, but people who are empaths also have a lot of chemical and environmental sensitivities. So this formula could help them just feel like buffered in a way.
Yeah. Will you talk also a little bit about your most popular, your best-selling, I think it's First Aid Kit.
First Aid Kit is big, and I'll talk about that one because it's the most it's the universal formula. So all of these formulas are more, you know, they're all specific, and they're very specific to your emotional state, and the more specific you can be, the more effective the remedy will be when you're choosing a formula. But First Aid Kit is the all-purpose fast-acting stress reliever for trauma or small stresses. So you could take it if you have an accident or a fender bender or something, or a fall, to kind of neutralize the trauma. Or you can take it for small stresses like being stuck in traffic or flying. I always take it before air travel or, you know, meetings or if public speaking, because I got fear of public speaking, and I dose on the first aid kit like every 10 minutes before that kind of thing. And it really works. And or menstrual cramps, headaches, anything that just feel where you feel off and it, you know, is a thing that suddenly appeared. It's not for like a long-term chronic thing.
And Alexis, that one you can take with other ones, correct? Like the other one.
Yeah.
You should take only one at a time, but that one you can.
Correct. Yeah. The other ones you would choose one. Mm-hmm. What's going on, you know, go, what's really happening right now, and pick a remedy for that. Take it till it's finished, which is about a month, but then you can take the first aid kit as needed during that time on your regular formula. Oh, beauty. You guys are going to have beauty formula, aren't you?
Yeah. Tell me about that.
Oh my God. This is my favorite formula. I love it because it's so cool what it does. And I think because, well, you've got your LA store, you know all about this, but it's widespread. But, you know, there's a terrible affliction in our current society. And for the last, well, I mean, it's been forever, but it seems to just be getting worse that people feel really unattractive and critical of their looks and think they need to change things. And so I saw a lot of that. I mean, even modeling, I saw the most beautiful women I'd ever seen just hating themselves and they're fat and look at my skin. And I did it to myself. So I already came from that place. And it wasn't until my sister, my older sister said that she wanted to get Botox in her 11s, you know, the furrows between your eyebrows. Uh-huh. And I just thought, no, you don't do this. It's just like, and we were raised by this woman who, you know, my mom never gave us a drug or wore makeup. Or I thought, no, that you don't get Botox. Let me give me a shot at this. And so I said, let me make you a flower remedy and let's just see if it changes your face. Just give it a month. And like, then you can get Botox if it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. So I went to work tinkering on this formula and I thought, well, I need to give her something to relax her facial muscles because she's an intense person. And you know, intense people, they make a lot of facial expressions and tense their faces. So I started with that idea of I need to find remedies to relax the person. And but then I started thinking about the whole, like I was talking about the societal stuff and the what we go through. And I thought, I want to make a formula that both does make you look better. So like Botox and filler that plumps your skin, that removes under eye circles, that relaxes the facial muscles and helps nasolabial folds and all those physical concerns. But I thought, I want also for the person to feel really beautiful inside and confident. So I made this formula, beauty formula number 8, that does both of those things. And it is really, she didn't get Botox.
Really?
Yeah, she said it totally worked. She kept saying, I think it's working. And she said, but I feel really good too. And I almost, she said, and a lot of people say this, I look better, but also I just don't care how I look now. And like, which is really attractive. Like people say, you look great. What are you doing? And it's just, as soon as you stop caring about how you look and focusing on it, there's a kind of carefree confidence about it. That's I just love that formula. I think it's so special.
All right. Well, I'm going to do that after Pathos.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Do Pathos first. And it's great for the skin too. So even though it's called the anti-aging formula, it is really good for breakouts as well. So, you know, at any age we can get those. And
you seem to be really affected by the place that you live and the places that you travel. And
yes,
you just moved to Joshua Tree from
LA. Yeah. Yeah. I'm technically in a place called 29 Palms, which is the next town over, but nobody knows that place. So strange. It's so different from LA after living there my whole life, but so peaceful and utterly silent. I mean,
and weirdly, so many colors in the desert. I love the desert.
Yeah. Isn't it funny? Like I thought growing up that it was just kind of a vast no man's land of brown. And then now that I live here, I do, like you said, I see a lot of colors, so many animals.
Yeah.
I've got wild rabbits that I feed and little quail and hawks and owls. And Aww. It's really special.
we ask a question of everybody that it comes on the podcast, and I don't know if you're prepared for it, but
okay, probably not. But
no, what did you wear to prom, and or did you go to prom?
Oh my God, this is a great story. Here's what happened. Because I was modeling and always at auditions and stuff, I started thinking this high school thing is for the birds, you know? And so I took the proficiency test, and I had already graduated early because I started early and I skipped kindergarten or something. And so I was 16 and when I left high school, and I left in my senior year, like the second month, I just couldn't wait to get out of there and start living my life. And then my friend said, hey, our friend Doug, you know, his date bailed on him. Will you go to the prom with him? And I thought, okay, I'll slum it with you kids. I'll make a guest appearance. And so I got a dress. I had just seen, okay, I think it was like, I don't know what, the Fabulous Baker Boys. I was really into Michelle Pfeiffer.
Michelle Pfeiffer, love.
Her. She's one of my beauty style icon expander people. So
for sure.
I had seen that movie, and I think she does a scene like on top of a grand piano singing Making Whoopee or whatever, or some other classic. And she was wearing a velvet, tight velvet dress. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I absolutely do. But I can't, was it sleeveless or had a sleeve?
It was sleeveless and it had straps and a kind of, what's the neckline? Not sweetheart, but like a little bit of gather at the bust, like, and then straps, like wide strap zipper at the back, tight.
So it's like, and probably it's cut, so it's sort of draped in the front, or no?
Maybe not draped. Maybe a tiny bit of ruching. I'm not sure, but it was a mini dress, you know, and it was and she's tiny, and it was tight, and but it wasn't tacky or slutty or anything. I thought, oh, I want to wear a dress like that, and so I found one. And but in black and black velvet. And like, I looked very sophisticated. I can't believe, I'll send you a picture actually when we get off the phone. My friend just sent me a picture from that night, and I'm wearing this incredible dress, and I was a ballet dancer and my body looked so great. And I didn't appreciate it, of course, at the time, but so I wore that and insanely high heels. I don't know how I walked.
Black shoes?
Black, yeah, a black pump, you know, like a heel, really high heel. And I just thought, I'm wearing point shoes, just like, that's how I kept my posture up. And then I wore some stockings, like some really sheer black stockings. And I just remembered that this dress came with a beaded bolero, like a bolero jacket.
In black as well?
Yes, that had, I mean, and it wasn't a fancy or expensive dress, but it was like the only one in the store. And this great bolero jacket with antique-y beading and kind of big shoulder pads, you know, it was late 80s. It is a great outfit. I wish I still had it.
And tools, or do you remember how you did your hair or any of that?
Oh, I had hair. I had straight hair down to my waist with bangs because I was into like Paulina Portskova, right? I just had it all silky straight down, wore it down. And I think I wore some kind of earring that was like not great, maybe some little hearts that were like on a beaded heart or something. All this detail is coming back to me. It's so funny. What a great time it was. I mean,
yeah,
I've been so nostalgic lately since lockdown. I just, I never used to be, but I really think about the past a lot.
Thank you so much. What We Wore is produced by Capital and Balto Creative Media. The original song, Someone So Enchanting, was composed and performed by Britt Drozda. What We Wore is a member of the Queen City Podcast Network, powered by Ortho Carolina. Find out more at queencitypodcastnetwork.com.